Hi, I'm David Lazarus, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of January 25th, 2013.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
We have been buried in housing news this week. New home sales, existing home sales, housing inventory, foreclosures, repossessions. Yow! That's a lot of great data, and we live for that here at The Money Show. But here's the thing. It's all contradictory. You'll read in one publication that the housing market is recovering, and then you'll hear some expert elsewhere saying that we're still in the dumps. I mean, what the heck? So we've decided to cut through the confusion and get to the bottom of things. For the next several weeks on Marketplace, Marketplace Morning Report, and on this fine show, we'll be digging into the foundations of the housing market to find out what's really going on in real estate. Let's start right now by talking with Glenn Kelman. He's president and CEO of Redfin. That's a real estate and technology company that's been tracking housing trends, well, for almost a decade now. Glenn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So before I put you on the hook, let me just download some of the housing news we've had this week. First, we have the Federal Housing Finance Authority saying home prices were up more than 5.5% compared to last year, which is pretty darn good. We've got new home sales numbers this week up more than 8% on last year. RealtyTrack says repossessions are down 3% from last year. And Lender Processing Services says the number of homes in foreclosure is way down, 18% from last year. But inventory is reduced, which can mean higher prices, but also fewer sales. And we heard this week that sales of existing homes were down in December. So some parts of the country doing well, others not so much. Glenn, what is the scoop?
I think we're back. Prices are up about 10% year over year nationwide. There are some markets that aren't doing quite as well as that, but there are others that are just roaring. Arizona and California lead the way. There we see less than a month of supply. People are going crazy trying to buy homes. Demand has been extremely strong. People are very excited about trying to buy a home. Their frustration is that they just can't find one to buy.
What about all the foreclosed properties that were clogging up the inventory pipeline out there? Have we worked our way through that?
Mostly we have. I think banks have figured out that it takes 2 years to kick somebody out of a house, and usually they lose about 50 cents on the dollar when they do. And so now they just approve a short sale or modify the loan. And as a result, we're seeing more Americans able to sell a home without having to hit the bricks, without having to clear out because of a foreclosure.
Now, you bring up short sales. Heretofore, banks have been very reluctant to do short sales. It was like pulling teeth with them to sell the property for less than what is owed on the mortgage. And yet lately, we've been hearing noises from the banking industry of, oh, well, we've seen the light and we're going to do more short sales. Do you believe that?
I absolutely believe it. In places like Arizona, the whole reason the market's recovered is because banks have gotten a lot more liberal about approving short sales and much more reluctant about going after someone in a foreclosure. It takes too long. There are too many legal costs. After the robo-signing scandal, I think they just got religion about short sales and said, let's approve it and make it a lot faster and easier than it had been before. So really, the past year has been the year of the short sale, and that's the main reason the market's come back.
And that robo-signing scandal, that's $8.5 billion worth of penalties. Thank you very much to the banking industry for their practices there. Now, one last question. That's interest rates. Interest rates are still at fire sale prices. If I'm in the market for a home right now, is this the time to jump at it?
Well, it's hard to say that about every market and every situation, but certainly money's not going to get any cheaper. I think it's tough to say when home prices are going to bottom in any particular market, but we know that mortgage rates have hit a bottom. So before you buy a house, you have to buy the money to buy a house, and the money will never be cheaper. These are historic lows, and that's really what's driving most of the demand.
Okay, so you can get money at bargain basement prices. The 30-year mortgage rate was up a fraction this week, but it's still down at 3.42%, which is not too shabby. Of course, that's assuming you can get a loan. And we've had a lot of letters from you about homes and mortgages and other real estate matters. Glenn Kelman is going to stay with us to answer some of them later on in the show, so stick around for that. I was brought up on this notion of the American dream. House, dog, two-car garage, you know, real Ozzie and Harriet stuff. But that's a dream that the Keeping Up with the Kardashians crowd just isn't sharing. By that I mean young people say they have no interest in ever owning a home. They've seen the results of a huge boom and bust in the housing market. They don't want to be trapped by debt. So these days, more and more people are renting. Now, some economists say a population of renters makes for a more flexible workforce. But commentator Chris Farrell says buying is still a better option for all concerned.
The diss on owning a home these days is too glib. The Rent is the Future crowd is making the same mistake as housing boosters did during the boom, that current conditions will stay the same well into the future. During the bubble years, people took on huge mortgages, insurance payments, and other costs, convinced that prices would keep skyrocketing. When the market collapsed, many owners were left anchored down by an underwater mortgage, or worse, sunk by a foreclosure. The conventional wisdom that renting beats owning misses a shift in the market. In many parts of the country, the monthly cost of owning, including the mortgage and taxes, is less than renting. The trick remains finding a bank willing to lend you the money to buy a house. Still, demographic trends favor owning a home. A majority of those 65-plus own. Older people like growing old in their own place, and the massive baby boom generation will swell the ranks of the elderly. Immigrants are coming in record numbers, and owning is a classic milestone of making it in their new country. And as the economy improves, the boomerang generation will flee their parents' basement and start their own families. Some will decide buying beats renting. One of the more intriguing changes favoring owning is the internet. Americans are moving around looking for a place to settle in fewer numbers than before. The internet has taken out much of the guesswork. It's easy to gather information online. The result? A more efficient economy at matching people and place. I bet they'll put down roots by buying once they've made their choice. The real takeaway from the housing bust is that speculating with too much debt and too little equity is always perilous. It doesn't pay to own without prudent financing. Still, most Americans will find there comes a time when they'll want the freedom that comes from owning a home rather than abiding by the rules of a landlord. The right question is at what price?
Chris Farrell is the economics correspondent for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. One of the reasons that home prices are going up in many neighborhoods around the country is because investors are buying houses, sprucing them up, and then renting them out. Landlords like these often don't have a great image. They're seen as vultures squeezing what they can out of a community. But as Charlie Mintz reports from Oakland, California, they can be an enormous force for change and for good.
Stand outside the Golden 7 liquor store by the drug dealers or by the Lighthouse Church where Pastor Joe Chapman does double duty as a barber. And you can see almost to the end of Mead Avenue. The street's just a block long. It's part of West Oakland, a neighborhood known for art and industry, but also drugs, gang violence, and since the financial crisis, foreclosures.
The porch was all caved in. The doors were all kicked in. There's just like needles and mattresses, and it was like a crack house, right? People were just squatting in it, and somebody locked the dog in there until it died.
That was how 864 Mead looked in 2009, when Chris Alonji bought the two-story Victorian for $148,000. He spent 2 years fixing it up himself. Now it has a brand new garden, new bamboo floors, and the tenants, they're new too.
Hey!
Ilya Lazowick is a barista making California's minimum wage, $8 an hour, plus tips. Not much, but $400 monthly rent makes it work for this new resident.
Where I'm from, it's a very predominantly white, like, town, like, small town in Oregon, like, and I moved down here and I was like, oh my goodness, like, I'm the white girl.
A lot of West Oakland's newest residents are white. Blame San Francisco rents, the highest in the nation. But on this side of the bay, at least on Mead Avenue, being a landlord means doing more than just profiting from geography.
Yeah, we're just setting up some cameras and putting four here. We already put four down the street.
Mired in snaking black cords, Alonji configures surveillance cameras on a nearby house. The cameras aren't just an investment in his property. They're an investment in the whole block. It's the same with the street trees he helped plant. They're skinny, delicate things now, but if they survive and grow, he thinks they'll improve Mead Avenue. Alex Miller-Cole thinks so, too.
It prevents people from shooting up cars and freestyle driving really fast down the street and from dealing drugs, doing violent crime, you know. It's a very big deterrent to have the cameras out.
I just became a citizen on May 5th of this year. I intend to live and die here. So I'm very interested that this whole place gets better.
Miller Cole owns six houses in West Oakland, including 861 to 865 Mead. It's a yellow fourplex right across the street from Belongi's.
We completely gutted the place down to the studs, and yet we bought this unit, this four-unit building, for $175,000. That means nothing per unit. You couldn't possibly build it for what it cost.
Now he charges $1,500 a month for each of the four units. It's good money, considering the neighborhood's reputation.
At one time, this block, is one block long, was the worst block in Oakland, California. There was a lot of killing on this block back in the day.
Leroy Stanfield owns 825 Mead Avenue. It's a single-story Victorian with Chinese flares. His house was worth $500,000 at the top of the market. Now it's down to about half that.
But I think the property is going to go back up within the next 5 years. It's going to be going the right way. Because the neighborhood is coming pretty clean. A whole lot cleaner than what it used to be.
For a couple years, that seemed to be the case. Then, a few days after Christmas, two men were murdered on the corner by the liquor store. For landlord Jeff Creer, it was just more confirmation that he was right to keep his buildings on and near Mead Avenue empty.
Part of the reason that I board up buildings is to make a point, is look, I will sacrifice financially to get across a point that I'm only interested in the right type of tenants.
Jeff Creer's been on Mead Avenue 3 decades. He boarded up 815 Mead about 10 years ago after he evicted the last tenants. They were hard drug users, exactly the kind of tenants Creer worries the block attracts. But now, Mead Avenue boasts a school board member, graduate students, baristas. All kinds of people want to live here.
Has anyone tried to buy the building you own on Mead from you?
There's constantly people attempting to buy the building.
Mead Avenue might be turning a corner, but Creer's still worried about the corner, the one outside the liquor store, where people are still getting shot. So for now, he's not selling, and he's not renting either. It's the last empty property on the block. In Oakland, I'm Charlie Mintz for Marketplace.
Time now for my favorite part of the show, when we get to your letters. We're focusing on housing this week. Redfin CEO Glenn Kelman is stuck around, so he's going to help out with some of the letters we're getting about pressing real estate issues. Just to remind you, Redfin is a real estate and technology company that's been tracking housing trends for almost a decade now. Thanks for staying with us, Glenn.
Thanks for having me, David.
All right, our first caller is Nicole, calling from Stone Mountain, Georgia. Hi, Nicole.
Hey, how's it going?
How are things in Stone Mountain, Georgia?
Chilly. It's cold.
Really? Is Stone Mountain, is it near Atlanta?
Yeah, it's pretty much Atlanta.
Oh, okay.
Yes, technically, it's Stone Mountain.
And Atlanta, kind of a tough housing market all around. I mean, a lot of demand to live there. What do you do?
I am a manager of a business. I sell natural cosmetics.
What's a natural cosmetic? Does that mean you're not testing it on animals or what?
It's just cosmetics made with low preservatives and fresh fruits and vegetables and stuff that's really good for your skin.
I'm sorry. Are you telling me that I'd be spreading fresh fruits and vegetables on my skin?
Yes. You should do that right now.
Really? Okay, I want you to picture me smearing a beet all over my face.
Hey,
There I go. Now I got
Why
the
not
look.
Hurt?
Now it's working for me. All right, what's your question?
Yeah, we bought our house in 2007, just right before, you know, the economy went down. And we bought it for $163,000, and we got one mortgage at 6%, one mortgage at 8%. And, you know, we have a kid. We have another one on the way. And the property value, of course, has gone down tremendously. We have no equity in it. We're underwater in it. We are eligible for a refinancing, but that expires at the end of the month. And it's for people like us who've paid our mortgage on time. And we're waiting for the other mortgage to submit a subordination. And it's just not happening for whatever reason. We've kind of tried to wait out the economy and wait out what was going on and figure that the property value will go up. But we just feel like we're paying a lot for a mortgage every single month, and we need to be able to put some money away to save.
So where's your indecision here? What do you need to know?
We're thinking if this refinancing doesn't happen, we're thinking of a short sale. Mm,
okay.
And just maybe possibly finding another house or just kind of finding housing somewhere else until we can maybe get some debts paid off and trying this all over again.
So you're wondering if a short sale is a good move and how it might affect your credit, for example, and your prospects for buying another property?
Yeah, we've looked into it. It looks like it will, but we think it might affect our credit. But at the same time, we'd really like to just pay off our debt. So that might be better for our credit.
Sure. Okay. There's a couple of moving parts to this. And Glenn Kelman, the whole notion of having two mortgages and not having both lenders play ball on a refi, that's frustrating.
Right. The more mortgages there are, the harder it is to get everybody to agree to take a loss. What I would encourage you to do is to keep paying your mortgage. There was a time when you really had to stop paying your mortgage before anyone would pay attention to a short sale.
But that's a dangerous game.
That's a dangerous game. That's a nuclear option.
Yeah.
I don't think you want to do that, especially since you can now get an FHA loan as long as your short sale involved a property where you'd been paying the mortgage for 12 consecutive months. So if you've been up to date on your mortgage, you can go ahead and apply for a short sale and still be able to buy another home using an FHA loan, even if you turn right around and try to do that.
Is there anything Nicole can do to facilitate the conversation between her two mortgage holders to get them onto the same page?
Well, I think you just want to talk about where you're at financially. So if you've got another baby on the way, you're financially struggling, you've got all sorts of debt, you can apply to have a means-tested short sale. I wouldn't, as I said, stop paying the mortgage. I would simply explain to them that you don't have the money to continue making the mortgage payment. And at that point, I think that you've got a good opportunity to get that short sale approved.
You know, we've been talking about the housing market and the question of whether your underwater home is ever going to resurface. No one can really say at this point. Do you know how deep underwater you are?
About 80,000.
It's a lot. And you're going to want to keep that in mind when you make your next move. A short sale could be the smart play, but you got to get everybody on board.
Thank you, gentlemen.
All right, Nicole, we wish you all the best of luck. Thank you.
Bye.
Coming up, we'll hear from a couple of callers who have outgrown their homes. And we'll talk about what to do when money problems hit home next.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
I'm David Lazarus. I'm joined by Glenn Kelman. He's the CEO of the real estate site Redfin. That's where real estate, technology all come together into one happy place. Also, we're going to be posting some data from you guys about the housing market on our website, marketplace.org.
What we're going to show you is just how much inventory has declined year over year. We thought that in 2013, we would open the year with the broad consensus for the first time in 5 years that prices were rising, and that would draw more people to sell their homes. But in fact, in the opening weeks of the year, we've seen continued decreases in inventory, which will limit the number of sales, which will drive prices up, which will frustrate a lot of home buyers.
All right. So you can crunch the numbers, as usual, at marketplace.org. Okay, let's get back into your calls. And our next caller is Dennis, calling from Pearland, Texas. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, how you doing?
Where's Pearland? Help me out there.
Oh, Pearland is about 13 miles from downtown Houston.
Oh, okay. So it's not out in the boonies, per se.
Oh, no, no. Definitely not.
And when I say boonies, I mean that in the nicest possible way. You know that.
Yes.
What do you do, Dennis?
I'm a technology cost management specialist.
What on earth does a technology cost management specialist do?
I just tell you how to spend your money and where your money's going.
All right. Well, you're just the man for this show, and yet you've got a question.
Yes, I do. It's a very interesting scenario. So we got a house in 2005. It's a three-bedroom, two-bathroom, and we have one kid now. And right now, only one bedroom is available for use. So we are considering going to a larger home. The current home has very comfortable mortgage payment, nothing to worry about. Now, we looked at the market, and homes in our neighborhood sell for about $88 to $120 per square foot. And the home we are looking at is twice the size and twice the mortgage. The question that we have is kind of like a three-side question. So part one of this is we do nothing. We stay where we are. And we have no more room to grow. And we're planning to have another baby this year. But if we stay where we are, we get to pay off a whole lot of debt.
Okay, so you're cozy, but you're debt-free. Okay, I'm okay on scenario one. What's scenario two?
Scenario two is we get a slightly larger home without any equity, maybe about $89 per square foot, 3,500 square foot home.
Okay, more elbow room, more debt. And what's your third scenario?
The third scenario is I have this very awesome short sale that is in the neighborhood selling for about $70 per square foot, but it's the largest home. It's close to 5,000 square feet.
Holy cow, that's palatial.
It's got twice the mortgage. And we are going, is it worth moving to a bigger home if you think there's going to be an upside down the line?
All right, so the third scenario is the Jed Clampett scenario, swimming pool, movie stars. I got it. So what you got to balance now is essentially your need for more room at home and more room to grow versus your appetite for financial risk, because that's what you're going to be taking on. And Glenn Kelman, this is clearly a question, especially as the economy improves, that a lot of families are asking.
Well, I wouldn't get in over your head too fast. I mean, we just got out of this jam. I don't want folks to get right back into it. The one question I had about the short sale, how do you know that that's what it will really sell for?
Well, they have accepted a contract on it, and we are still waiting. It's been almost 4 months now, but they've accepted it.
My concern is just that the bank will have an asset manager say that home is worth more than that and ask for more money later. They don't want to feel like just because they gave it up on the mortgage that they're also going to give away the farm on the price. So they just want to make sure they're being fairly treated. So it may be that once the bank actually approves the sale, that the price has to go up.
Dennis, I got to say, I think out of your three scenarios, scenario two seems to be the strongest. You clearly are making sounds like you want some more room. You got a new baby coming. And, you know, a house is an investment. You're investing in your future. You're investing in your family. And that's all good. Those are good things to invest in,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a lot of other things I can think of, like a new Ferrari, for example. So your second scenario, you had more room and you had a modest increase in your mortgage,
yeah.
correct?
Yeah.
Can you handle that increase?
Absolutely.
Why wouldn't you do that?
I would also handle scenario three. It may require a little bit of adjustment, but it's just so attractive.
5,000 square feet. What are you going to do with it, though? I mean, honestly, you're going to put in a bowling alley? I mean,
probably
really?
Flip it.
Oh, that's a whole other thing.
No.
Is that a game you've ever played before?
No, absolutely not.
I would say, and I'm guessing Glenn's going to back me up here, don't swim with sharks if you don't have to.
Yeah, I think that the simplest way to make money in real estate is to buy and hold. If you're going to go flipping properties, there's transaction costs that will just eat you up. So I would probably do the mid-sized option too.
And that's what I would do. Dennis, does that work for you?
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Good luck with that. We got time for one more caller. Let's go over to Jen calling from St. Anthony, Minnesota. Hiya, Jen.
Hi.
I'm guessing chilly in Minnesota.
Yes, we've had highs in the negatives the past few days.
Remember, you're talking to a couple of people sitting in Los Angeles. I feel your pain, Jen. Yeah. I really do. Sorry. What's your housing question?
We are in a 3-bedroom, 1.5-bath ranch-style house right now, and we are expecting our fourth child.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. So we're looking to expand the house a little bit. We think we're okay on bedrooms, but we really need more bathrooms,
mm-hmm.
and we need to remodel the existing bathrooms.
Mm-hmm.
We are the second owners of the house, so there's been a lot of deferred maintenance and things like that. And I'm wondering what the best course of action for getting the money for that is. Is it to try and get a second mortgage? Is it to get a construction loan? Is there some third secret option C that I don't know about?
The secret option. All right, let's turn to Glenn and see what he has to say.
I would probably talk to three different people about this. You should talk to a lender and just figure out how much capital you can access, but you should also talk to a contractor to figure out what the cost of the renovation would be. And then the third person I would talk to would be a real estate agent. I would want to make sure that you could get that money out of the property when it was time to sell it. You don't want to renovate a property such that it's the nicest house on the block or the nicest house in the neighborhood. Because it's then hard to get that money back when you hang a sign in the front yard. And then finally, I might talk to my husband to see if you can take the madness of a renovation with three kids and a fourth on the way, because it is a big commitment.
And you're not going to be living in the house at the time. So you're going to be somewhere else almost certainly for much of the renovation. You're going to uproot everybody. And that's hard. I mean, logistically speaking, that's a thing. Yeah. So do you think you can handle that?
I think we could handle that. We really, really, really want to stay in the school district and the neighborhood. And most of the homes here were built at the same time and are the same size. And if they have been expanded, it's been recently. Most people are the second owners like we are. And so they're not moving.
Jen, have you ever missed a mortgage payment?
No.
Good. Then you pass the marketplace money test right out of the gate. And I would say that puts you in a very good position to talk to the bank and make your case. You say, look, we love the house. We're good customers. We always make our payments. And guess what? We'll make bigger payments because you're going to increase the size of the loan. My guess is they're going to jump at that opportunity. Jen, what does your husband do?
He's a web consultant.
A web consultant. That doesn't sound like something that has a steady income, or am I wrong?
Well, he is the president of his own S-Corp, and he has been for about 10 years now. And I know in the past, that's been something that the banks have not been thrilled about, that he's his own employer.
Right.
But he does very well at it.
Yeah, it's all about the balance sheet.
Okay.
Well, I think they're also concerned just about the steadiness of the income. So you're right to focus on just how regular his income has been.
And I think the remodel is probably a smart bet. If you like the house, if you like the school district, if you like your neighbors,
mm-hmm.
and so moving somewhere else probably is going to create more headaches than you want.
Right.
I agree. The only thing that I would be cognizant of is just when it's time to sell it, because it sounds like all the houses in your neighborhood are very similar. So you'll really be an outlier because you'll have an extra bathroom and more space. But the question you have to ask yourself is, can I get that $100,000 back?
Well, hopefully if we get more bathroom, we won't need to move for a while.
There you go. Jen, I hope that helps.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for calls today. Glenn Kelman is CEO of the real estate website Redfin.com. Glenn, thanks so much for being here.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Okay, now that you've paid your mortgage or your rent or your closing costs, how much do you have left over? More to the point, how much of what's left do you carry around as cash? Not much, am I right? More people are going cashless these days as technology makes it easier to deal in digital dollars. And that's bad news for churches. Houses of God still receive the bulk of their donations in cash or checks. But as Shannon Mullen reports, some churches have traded their collection baskets for newfangled devices.
The Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston is the mother church of the city's Catholic Archdiocese. Its rector, Father Kevin O'Leary, says the building costs a lot to maintain.
We're looking at maybe $1.5 million to keep it from falling in outside.
Then there's the free clinic, the food pantry, school programs for low-income kids. The church still collects most of its donations in baskets on Sunday, in cash or checks. But O'Leary says his congregation's getting younger, and the way parishioners give is changing.
People carry less and less cash. It really is, myself included. And credit cards are used for everything. And I think, really, it is the reality in the near future, if not the present.
Just inside the main entrance of the cathedral, I ran into Joey LaMartina, who stopped by the gift store. He says he tries to get to church every Sunday.
I will go to like a Walgreens or somewhere to pick up some cash before I go to church, just because I oftentimes will find myself showing up here and realizing I don't have any cash on me.
Enter the digital collection kiosk. The cathedral installed the touchscreen unit in December, mounted on a shelf under a big stained glass window. Now tourists and parishioners like LaMartina can use it to make donations with a credit or debit card any day of the week.
If I didn't have cash on me, I would absolutely do that. I personally didn't even know that this was something that exists.
The company that makes the kiosks, SecureGive, says a learning curve is normal. Stuart Baker is director of business development.
You know, sometimes it takes, you know, 4 or 5 months just for the congregation to kind of understand, first off, that it's even there and to realize, you know, what it's there for.
Baker says the kiosks usually pay for themselves in a few months. They start at $1,500 plus a setup cost and a $40 monthly licensing fee. About 900 churches are using them nationwide, and Baker says sales have tripled since the company rolled out an iPad version last fall. Some models print receipts for people to put in the collection basket so they don't feel guilty when it passes by. And those with smartphones can use mobile apps to donate right from the pew. Most churches still use collection plates, but each year more offer some way for people to give electronically. Brian Cluth studies religious philanthropy for an annual State of the Plate survey. He says over 40% of churches now accept donations online, through kiosks or other digital methods, a 10% bump from 4 years ago. And Cluth adds, the percentage of people who give electronically is going up too.
We are in a world where it's not about the methodology that people give, not even the frequency, but being faithful. And I encourage churches, give them any opportunities they can to help them be faithful. And if people can do that electronically, then help them to do that.
Some churches don't want people in debt donating with credit cards. And some philanthropy researchers say kids might not donate as adults if they don't see their parents putting money on the collection plate. On the upside, Cluth says e-giving tends to be more consistent than cash, like online bank transfers that go through even when a donor skips church. And back in Boston, Father O'Leary thinks e-donors are more generous than those in his flock who still carry cash.
I think people feel freer to use their credit card, and I think it actually does. If you have to go into your wallet and say, should I give two or five, and nobody knows my name, you might give the two, but who knows?
In Boston, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
We've all heard stories of people in their 50s and 60s delaying retirement because of the economy. Well, it turns out people 75 and older are working longer too, for lots of reasons. The Bureau of Labor Statistics projects that by 2020, 10% of the 75-plus crowd will still be in the labor force. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Kate Davidson reports.
The number of 75-plus workers has grown to about 1.3 million people. The phrase 75-plus worker is hard to say, so I'm going to call those folks the retireless. The retireless are still a tiny part of the overall workforce. But it wasn't hard to find one. I just took the elevator to the basement and asked my building's super how old he is.
Well, if you believe this, on January 6th, I was 76 years old.
Carl Jones has worked in this New York apartment building for 43 years.
I'm happy when the body says to me, okay, it's time to give it up, then I stop.
He says he could stop, but work keeps him going.
I've seen so many of my past co-workers here that retired and just fade away. And I don't want to join that clique.
That's a common feeling among the retireless, this growing group of seniors who are collecting and paying into Social Security at the same time. 83-year-old Peter Koch is another one. You can find him at his family's lingerie store, The Town Shop.
There are thousands and thousands of bras downstairs.
Lingerie and longevity are in this man's blood. His mother was a famous bra fitter. When she died, her obituary read, she was 95 and a 34B. Koch collects Social Security, a pension, his salary, and he has a 401K. He says it's plenty to retire on. But at work, he has his customers, his son, and lots of employees.
It's just fun, and we have fun, and there's plenty of headaches and plenty of heartaches through the years, but for the most part, it's fun, and we enjoy it.
Which is all to say, working later is not just about the recession.
This is a trend that's been going on far longer than the past 5 years.
Sarah Ricks is a senior advisor with AARP's Public Policy Institute. She says the rate at which people over 75 participate in the workforce has been growing since 1990. She says economic factors do play a part, like reductions in retiree health benefits and the shift from guaranteed pensions to defined contribution plans, like 401ks. But for this age group, she thinks it's mostly about health and choice.
People 75 and over are far more likely than their younger counterparts to be self-employed, so they can scale back their work hours. Many of them are likely to be in the professions, law, medicine, accounting.
Of course, being self-employed and elderly can be hard.
Would you like a cup of tea or coffee to warm up?
Barbara Garrison is 81. Okay, she's an artist and an illustrator. Whimsical dancing bears grace her hallway.
You like black or green?
Green, please.
Okay. Garrison has battled cancer and pneumonia. About a year ago, she lost half the sight in her left eye. But she's still working.
Because I need the money to live on. I have Social Security, which is around 700 and something a month.
and I have some retirement thing from teaching. So those two together just pay my maintenance of the apartment.
Working means she'll try to attend a dozen or more art shows this year to sell her prints. Some are far away, and she drives herself.
And now I've started driving with one eye closed. I drive carefully, and I'm give myself an extra day on a long trip.
She hires people off Craigslist to help her set up and break down. Garrison says she didn't really plan for retirement, but as a single mom, she was always thrifty. She tries not to worry about what's ahead. She says she remembers a long time ago.
I took my son and a little friend to, I don't know, something like it was very muddy, and your feet stuck in it, the mud, and you just had to pull your feet out one step at a time. And that's where, you know, when you're in that kind of situation, one step at a time.
But at 81, retirement is not a step she can afford. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
We all get sick or banged up from time to time, and occasionally it gets worse than that. In my case, I got bitten by my cat, the spawn of Satan, which turned into an infection, which turned into surgery, which turned into a week in the hospital, for a grand total of, wait for it, $52,660.53. Ouch! I got insurance, so that enormous bill, which is basically how much it'll cost to send my kid to college for a year, is not really what I owe. But how do you make sense of medical bills like this? To answer that, let's turn to Dr. David Feinberg. He's president of UCLA Health Systems, which runs UCLA Medical Center in Santa Monica, California, which was where I was treated. Dr. Feinberg, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Well, you've got some splaining to do. I'm looking at my bill right here, $12,000 for the surgery, $780 for the anesthesia, laboratory services, $4,000, on and on and on. How on earth can these things cost this much?
The current bill that you're looking at is really based on a system where part of that bill will be immediately reduced because of a contractual arrangement that your insurance company has with us. So in essence, there'll be a discount on that bill.
Well, let me look at that. So what I'm seeing here is that my insurer says that they will cover $38,448 of this, and my total due is a little over $1,500, which leaves $14,212.53 on the table. Where did that go?
So that's a discount. So that would be like when you would buy something on sale and they say it's 20% off or whatever that number comes out to be. That $14,000 or so is a discount because you're part of an insurance company that sends us a lot of business. And then the itemized items on the bill really are our best way of capturing everything that happened to you during the course of your treatment. And while I don't have the details of all your treatment, I do think you were in our emergency room, in our operating room. You got treated by a staff that's, you know, we spent a lot of money on training and coordinating the care. And the other part that's hidden, let's say, and I'll put that in quotes in that bill, is care for others. So likely in the rooms on either side of you, in the OR, before and after you, there were patients either with no insurance or insurances such as Medi-Cal that don't even cover our cost. So we, in essence, cost shifted. We put that uncovered cost into your bill.
But why shouldn't I think that this is a deliberate act of deception on your part?
Well, because I'm a good guy, and I don't think those of us that go into healthcare are actually trying to deceive others. From your vantage point, I completely get what you're saying. It's a crazy system, and we're working very hard to rationalize it. Everywhere else you go, they list the price, and you know what you're getting. And in healthcare, because of the history of how the finances went, it just doesn't have that in it, and we're really working to become much more transparent.
Well, let's go deeper into that premise. I've got my itemized bill in front of me. You charged me $16 for a Tylenol. No, check that. Not a proper Tylenol, a generic equivalent, $16.
Well, you know, when you go to a restaurant and you get a tomato and mozzarella salad for $11, the tomato costs 20 cents and the mozzarella costs 15 cents, but it costs a lot to keep the restaurant going and to train the waiting staff. So it's the same around the Tylenol. If you wanted with your cat bite, you certainly could have gone and got your own Tylenol, hired your own nurses, come up with your own OR at home, I mean, so to speak. What we really provide is that continuity of care and the entire package in one. When you start picking apart apart the bill and looking at some of those specific things, you know, the Tylenol that we deliver to you at that bedside is really actually expensive for us. I don't think we probably have a big margin on that $16. One, we got to buy the Tylenol. The people that deliver it are very, very highly trained. So it's a more complicated situation.
Dr. Feinberg, we spend $3 trillion a year on healthcare in this country. That's 17% of all economic activity. You've got to admit that any system in which there are $16 worth of cost to deliver a generic Tylenol is seriously messed up.
I completely admit that. I think we're seriously messed up. I mean, if you really look at the amount we spend on healthcare in this country, we don't hold a candle to other countries that spend far less. So to say our system is flawed or messed up, and if we want to use the Tylenol as the example of that, I would agree with you completely.
You alluded earlier to how things are changing, and I'm assuming that's due to the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare. What can we expect?
Well, I think it's really, really a fundamental change. A couple of things that are happening right now are those without insurance are getting the opportunity to be insured, and that'll take place over the next couple of years. That immediately will decrease how much I need to charge you for a Tylenol, because now the patient in the room next to you, now the patient in the operating room after you is actually coming in for care and associated revenue. So we won't have to shift the cost of the uninsured to those with insurance. That's going to be a big savings. And then two is to switch from a business where we make more money the more often you come in the hospital, the sicker you are and the more we do to you, to a new system where we'll be incentivized to keep you healthy. How fast will this transition take? I think we'll see really fundamental changes over the next 2 to 3 years.
Dr. David Feinberg is president of UCLA Health System, and he runs the hospital that I was at, UCLA Medical Center in Santa Monica. Dr. Feinberg, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So we've been talking about the one subject that Americans love to chat about, real estate. Now let's talk about a subject that we hate talking about, money. Discussing money can still make people uncomfortable. And so there are rules of social etiquette that most of us try to abide by. However, my guest today says those rules could use an update. Personal finance columnist Liz Weston joins me to talk about new money rules. Hi, Liz.
Hi, David.
I was looking at a column you had the other day talking about, you know, the do's and don'ts on the social setting when it comes to money. You even went to our friends at the Emily Post Institute for this one.
I love those guys. They are absolutely terrific. Doesn't matter what question I throw at them, they have an answer. And this was the case for all these questions I got from my readers about how to handle awkward money situations.
And before we get to some of those, I thought it was interesting that there are, in fact, some changing times. Like, for example, I don't know if you necessarily open doors for women anymore if you're a gentleman. I do.
Yeah.
But I think it's cool. But then when it comes to paying the bill, apparently it's not all my business anymore.
Exactly. It used to be you wanted the guy to pay the bill. I guess that was some sort of holdover of wanting to make sure he had some financial wherewithal. These days, the etiquette has changed, and it's much more appropriate to simply split the bill. That way, you can get to know each other without any sense of obligation. So, you know, manners do change over time, but the principles behind them stay the same. It's basically about respect and courtesy and wanting to do right by the other person.
Now, I can ask someone on a date, what do you do for a living? But I cannot ask, how much are you paid?
And this is really interesting, too, because I was wondering, is there a generational difference? Because those of our generation are pretty private about money. And I thought, well, maybe it's different, maybe because the younger generation is much more into sharing than we are. Maybe it's okay. I checked with Peter Post and he said, no, this is something that's absolutely personal. It's absolutely private. And it's not appropriate to ask someone how much they make or how much they paid for something. That's being nosy.
And yet I find that very interesting because this is the age of oversharing.
Yes.
This is the age of Facebook and Twitter. And yet there's still this bright, shiny line that you can't cross.
Exactly. And we're journalists, so we're used to asking really rude questions. How old somebody is, how much they make. But out in the social setting, those kind of questions are not something that's appropriate. Again, you're thinking about the other person. How is the other person going to react? If you know them well enough to know that they don't mind, well, maybe there's an exception there. But I'm talking general money manners. It's not some question that you want to pose if you don't want to put the other person at a disadvantage or put them ill at ease.
Let's say I've borrowed money from someone, Aunt Edith, a friend, whoever. We're in a social setting and Aunt Edith or whoever says, where's that money that I loaned you? Has she crossed the line?
Well, that's an interesting one because normally that's a private transaction between two parties and you kind of put yourself into the possibility of having this happen simply by borrowing money from a family member. That, you know, the guys at the Post Institute basically said it's not a good idea to do that. You know, people do it all the time, but it puts the relationship at risk. Now, your auntie probably shouldn't have brought it up in a social setting because that's meant to shame you. That's all that's about. So it's okay to change the subject and maybe come back to her later and say, these are my plans for paying you back, and I'd appreciate not having to discuss this among, you know, in front of other people, because it is between you and me.
A kid who knows that their grandparents dote on them, is that kid ever cool if he or she shakes them down for a little scratch?
Oh, that's another tough one. Kids should know that they should not be asking relatives for money. Now, relatives do give money all the time. That was something that was a tradition in my family. You know, grandparents might give money to kids or aunties or uncles. Asking for it is a whole different thing. And if you catch your kid shaking people down, like my husband did as a six-year-old. He went around to one of his parents' parties and asked people for quarters. They did the appropriate thing, which was pull them aside. No more of that. You give the money back. You want to teach your kids that they should be self-supporting and not, you know, hitting up the relatives for money. That could help you in your later years, by the way, if they've gotten that concept down and don't come to you to, you know, support their lifestyle.
My kid's 11. He's not deep into Shakespeare yet, but if there's one little bit I could share with him, it'd be Polonius saying, neither a borrower nor a lender be. Good advice, I thought.
It really is. I mean, we have these transactions in our families all the time. Somebody's a little hard up for money. They think it's okay to ask. But it really does create a negative situation. And one of the things that that Peter Post was saying is that you shouldn't feel bad turning down a family member for a loan. You're not the one that created the negative situation. They are, by asking you. At the best case, you know, they owe you money, and that's an uncomfortable place to be in. Worst case scenario, it turns into a gift, which it often does, and then you've got that hanging over your relationship for the rest of whatever. So it's hard to just say no, but in a lot of cases, it's the best thing to do.
Got a money faux pas to share? You can do so at marketplace.org. Liz Weston is a personal finance columnist whose work appears on MSN Money and in, yep, the LA Times, among other publications. Her website is asklizweston.com. Liz, thanks so much.
It's always a pleasure, David.
So what do you refuse to talk about when it comes to money, and why?
I generally would talk about most things related to money. It really depends on who I'm talking to.
Typically, I refuse to talk about things like my yearly salary, how much I pay in rent, how much I've paid for anything in general, even if it's something like my furniture. It just always feels uncomfortable, regardless if you're maybe not making as much as other people, like your friends, or maybe you're making more than your friends.
Being a writer and coming out of school, sometimes it's tough to find full-time employment, and it can be a little bit embarrassing or frustrating when people are, like, you know, shoving their salary down your throat over dinner. I don't really like to talk about how much I'm making. I wouldn't ask someone how much they're making.
Looking at stocks and bonds and mutual funds and those type of things, I don't really discuss that so much with people. I kind of keep that private to myself.
I think the best advice is to not talk about money at all, because that way you avoid embarrassing situations and you don't get into arguments.
And that'll do it for Marketplace Money for this week. Let us know what you think of the show at marketplace.org, or you can get in touch with us on our Facebook page. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Next time, the pros and cons of a new prepaid debit card for recovering drug addicts and alcoholics.
This card is not a relapse prevention tool. This is to help them in the transition from treatment back into society and help them get to the point where they're self-supporting, but they're doing so in a responsible manner.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Perinata. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yor. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times. Have yourself a great weekend.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.